We're frustrated with politicians. There's life in Australian democracy yet.
On ABC Radio, Louise Saunders.
Rebecca Huntley, your quarterly essay and Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation. You got me, I think, in the very first few pages when you said that our politicians, who we long considered to be poll-driven, aren't in fact poll-driven.
No, well, it depends on the poll. they're certainly, I think, one of the misnomers, because there's so much focus on polls. And, of course, there's so many polls and surveys that get a lot of media attention, is that's the things that are driving political decision making. Now, certainly, if a political party isn't doing very well, and if their leader isn't doing very well, then those polls could be used to further destabilise or do other kinds of things. But the kinds of polls I'm talking about are the kind of research that I'm involved in, which is, how do people feel about issues? And so there is a really kind of a laundry list of policy issues that Australians want, and the majority of Australians want some kind of movement on, and have wanted for some time. And politicians aren't necessarily looking at those polls. I mean, every now and then when they decide that they do want to do something, they might look at those issues. But they're not those polls, those surveys aren't driving their political agenda. Their political agenda is driven by a kind of whole complex of things. And sometimes on issues which are, for various reasons, controversial in the political parties but not in the community, and euthanasia is a perfect example. You know, for a long time there's been 70 to 80% support in the community for some kind of movement on euthanasia laws. It just hasn't. It's been the too hard basket for so many political parties, even though the public support is there.
I think you made the point, wouldn't you, that if the politicians did abide by what the public want, the ABC would be better funded, yes. We'd have more money in education and more money spent on our hospitals.
Yeah, we'd have world-class MBN. There's a lot of things we'd have. I mean, obviously, if you added all those things up and thought, well, what's financially possible, like what could we possibly fund, that's a separate question. But I suppose that I wanted to make the point that where the electorate are on a whole lot of issues and isn't necessarily reflected in either the political discussions that we see or some of the media commentary. And I think that there has been a kind of pent-up desire for reform in the electorate as a response to, you know, a decade plus of political turmoil at a time in which there have been incredible social and economic changes, incredible, you know, in the labour market, in the environment, in the area of technology, in social change. And we see those changes, you know, come through every time there's a census, every time there's any kind of this kind of survey. We see people realising, you know, is a robot going to take my job in 10 years' time? And, you know, is climate change going to dramatically affect our lives, or is it 30 or 40 years away? And while people start to, I suppose, see those things and process those things and think, oh, look, we really need to get on with it, there seems to be a kind of political stalemate on quite a few of those issues, or at least the perception that there is.
Perhaps you could call that the Canberra bubble that the Prime Minister refers to. He says he's outside it. Others may beg to differ. But do you think people see a disconnect between what they see as the politicians and their behaviour and the issues that they want addressed?
Look, I think in a way we're all in a bubble of our own. I mean, I'm only outside the bubble because I'm paid to be outside it. So I'm paid to kind of travel around Australia and talk to people that probably if I did a different job I'd never meet. And so I think that we can increasingly be in our own bubble because we can customise our own media. We can kind of decide now not to watch live television and get a lot of our media from, you know, the sources that reinforce or are already existing. You know, we can podcast the shows that we want, and we can tailor everything. So I think that Canberra bubble stuff, even though it exists, people wonder why politicians and what they care about seem kind of not completely disconnected, but not entirely connected to their life experience and what they're experiencing, is true. And look, part of that has to be, and I make the point in the essay, is the nature of the people in Parliament doesn't necessarily reflect the electorate. So a really big change, an obvious change, and the census shows it, is in the ethnic diversity of the population. Australia is becoming more ethnically diverse, you know, year in, year out with the census, and our parliamentary ranks haven't necessarily changed. And the kind of career trajectory of a lot of politicians isn't necessarily one of the rest of us. You know, most politicians are often career politicians, whereas the rest of us are bouncing around to different jobs. I mean, most of, you know, young people that I talk to expect to have six or seven different jobs, whether out of choice or not. So a lot of the things that happen to us, so not only who we are as a community, but our experience of the labour market, our experience of work, is quite disconnected from the people in Parliament. So there is that disconnect, but everybody's in a bubble, I think, to some extent.
Do you think that there is, are you seeing a greater connect then to the rise of the independents, whether they be politically and socially conservative or whether they, I guess what I've heard someone call informed independents? Can we see ourselves better in some of those, do you think?
Absolutely. And so I think what we are seeing is people more interested in locals and supporting locals or independents who perhaps haven't come up through the party machine. We're seeing, and we've seen in seats like Indi, but increasingly in other kinds of seats, this kind of model of a voice, you know, so a community group coming together, not necessarily supporting or against the two major parties or wanting to be part of the Greens or whatever, but saying, look, there are local issues and we want those local issues to be taken really seriously by our national politicians and play some, you know, role in what they prioritise. And so I think that, you know, regardless of whether that's on the conservative or progressive side of politics, I think that can only be a good thing. I'm very excited about how that's beginning to spread and potentially throwing up the kinds of candidates that wouldn't normally ever get a chance and get a chance to be in the national parliament. I mean, like or not, Jackie Lambie's a perfect example of that. And the power of somebody like that occasionally to stand up in parliament and say, I don't know what it's like to be on welfare. And most of the people in that chamber would not have that experience. And so I think the rise of the independents and some new voices in some of the minor parties have got to be a good thing.
That ground swell support is interesting too. You mentioned Indi, Warringah with Zali Steggles, yes. Perhaps another example, yep, of hundreds of people prepared to get out, turn on the T-shirt and get out there and do it all. It's a return to very old-style politics, isn't it, to be on the ground in the electorate and really focused and trying to get your person elected?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think the other area where we've seen a return to old-style politics in the younger generation is with some of the climate marches, you know. So, you know, while digital campaigning and social media can be a powerful political tool, I think people realise there's nothing quite as powerful as a meaningful conversation with somebody who is a neighbour about the political issues that matter to you. So I think it's not surprising that with this perception of a gridlock on particular issues that Australians are like, well, there's got to be another way to pull some of those levers of power, and I'm sick of just retweeting or being a keyboard warrior. I'm prepared to, you know, put on a political T-shirt for the first time in my life. I mean, the thing that's interesting when I kind of go around the traps and I meet some of the people involved in these campaigns is these aren't people who've ever joined a political party before. They might have done it in their 40s and 50s. They've really been pushed. And certainly for some of the, you know, younger people that got out onto the streets on the climate march, they may not have had parents. I mean, as much as people thought it was their parents pushing them, that might have been their first ever example of being at a political protest. So I'm really interested in this. It makes me realise that while we're frustrated with politicians, there's life in Australian democracy, yes.
The election campaign well and truly underway now. Given your research, your interpretation, what you've actually seen over the last couple of weeks, how does that fit with what you've written?
Well, I think the first thing is to don't assume people are paying too much attention quite yet. There's something about Easter and Anzac Day and a whole range of other things. One of the long-term trends is that people are, you know, sometimes close to a quarter of the electorate are voting before the day. So they're pre-polling. They say it's convenience, but part of me makes me think that they've already kind of made up their mind and they just want to get it done. Or either they think that whatever is being promised or said in the election campaign is meaningless. So they're making either side's not going to do anything about it once they're elected. So I mean, when you think about it, a quarter of the electorate, voting before the final day is an interesting one to me. We've seen recently the AEC has said that we've never had such a complete electoral roll because of something like 98% or something like that. So that will be interesting to see what's happening. I thought it would shape up to be an election in which climate was important, only because climate change policy and environmental policy and energy policy generally seems to have flummoxed, pretty much every leader since John Howard, and I say in the essay, it's become a policy area where we judge the capacity of a leader to lead their own party, which seems to be almost the thing that people are looking for the most. Like, before you even lead the nation, can you control your own party? And they feel uncertain about that on both sides.
Well, given the history.
Absolutely, and reasonably so. So all of the data that's coming out since the election is showing that environment is up there, certainly in the top five and sometimes eclipsing things like immigration, where we've seen obviously still seems very important to people. So it'll be interesting to see in the end people will have to make a value judgment about who they think is going to be able to A, get their party to stick to a policy, and B, manage that through the parliament and sell it to the electorate. In the end, I talk a lot in the essay about how Australians feel about, we want all these things, we want government to do all these things, but who's going to pay? So in the end, it's about that idea about, how do we fund the things we want government to be done? Are they going to be funded by higher taxes for particular kinds of people, or are they going to be funded in other ways? Like, how are we going to get that revenue? And so the argument is, shaping up very much to be, who do you trust to kind of be able to deliver those services without putting further pressure on lower and middle income people, which is not what anybody really wants.
Well, here's a great example of a social issue, and it's a big one in Tasmania as it is around the country, and you referenced it in the essay, and that is housing, affordable housing. That is a real problem, and it seems to me beyond what even the politicians acknowledge.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I find it frustrating when people often say, oh, this is just a kind of Sydney-Melbourne bubble conversation, and I just don't think that's the case. I think that you start to look at things like available and secure rental accommodation, you look at things like public housing, you look at, housing for older people, that's appropriate housing for people living with disability. Like, it is just not this idea that it's all about wealthy people wanting to wanting to buy second homes or wanting to get kind of, expensive apartments in Sydney and Melbourne. It's an issue everywhere, but it has local inflections. And so that is one area I've found in the time that I've been a researcher for the last 15 years that people have realised, look, we need such a complicated and innovative approach to housing. Saying that the market will work, it'll all be fine and the market will work it out, and all we've got to do is, give a bit of help to first home buyers and, release more land, that doesn't work. People realise that just saying you're going to invest in social housing isn't enough either. Like, how are you going to make sure that everybody's got a roof over their heads? And I think that the really kind of obvious sign for Australians that something is wrong is the rise of not only visible homelessness but invisible homelessness. The stories that they hear sometimes quite shocking of people who may in fact be working but are, finding it quite hard to have, permanent, housing
and situations. More and more women too in that category.
More and more women. And then, of course, parents reflecting on the fact that they're well-educated, hardworking kids, they just kind of think, well, what's going to happen, and what's going to be left after we've funded our own aged care for them really to be able to. So the idea that, you're going to pass on this parcel of land, seamlessly to your children, it'll all be fine, that doesn't happen either. So it's a huge issue, and one where people are crying out for all levels of government to take a kind of innovative and aggressive, I suppose, approach to making sure that the situation that we've seen build over the last 20 years doesn't get any worse. Mm.
Would that possibly be one area in which the regular respondent would say, damn the cost, just do something?
I think that they want to see the people that have made the most out of out of the housing industry give back. Mm. So this is why there's so much support for the idea that there be limits in foreign investment in the kinds of housing that, you know, and that there be requirements for property developers who are making really, really big profits to provide some affordable housing in every kind of development. And this is why there's some willingness to reconsider things like negative gearing law and all the rest of it. Nobody thinks that any one of those things is going to be the solution, but they think that a plethora of policies, which involves both more government investment, more requirements for private organisations to make a contribution in response to this terrific kind of, you know, money that they've been making. And I suppose part of it, you know, this is another thing I'd say. People do recognise that one of the challenges is us adjusting our expectations. So it's quite common to meet Australians that say, look, that we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that we're going to have live in smaller houses and think of new ways to mm-hmm. live. And so maybe this whole idea that you raise a child in an apartment, you can't possibly do that. Well, if we have enough green space, we're not going to put future cricket stars in jeopardy. If we find new ways to live, yep. So still living well with less, there is that recognition as well that's possible.
Which brings me to the word fair, which I think is such a key word in Australia. Australia Fair, it's the yep. national anthem. The Prime Minister talks about having a fair go. I think it's an Australian ethos to have a fair go, to be given a fair go. Do people want a fair go?
Yeah, this kind of egalitarian ideal is one that Australians, even though it's a cliche, one that they're still very attached to. They look around, they see this idea of, you know, like I said, more visible homelessness, you know, the idea of the working poor, the idea that, you know, there's some people doing two or three jobs, not being able to make ends meet, the idea that, you know, there's this growing gap between rich and poor, the idea that, you know, that we're supposed to still be a reasonably wealthy country, but wages aren't keeping a pace with other things, all of that stuff makes people wonder, well, you know, where is the bargain of hard work for some kind of secure life? It's breaking down, and it's breaking down for more people. Mm. And so people do wonder about that. Of course, it's up to leaders to say this vision of a fair go, how do we get there? And who has to, and what is the level of contribution that people have to make? At the moment, the cynical thing is that the very, very wealthy are doing better than ever, and everybody else is paying the price for that.
You mentioned the word vision. Has anyone used the word vision in politics since Paul Keating? Do we still need a vision thing?
Well, I make an argument. This is probably a bit controversial, a bit different than what I used to before, which is, I think one of the problems of this idea of having this kind of great visionary leader is that it's very easy to be disappointed with them. And I think the real path to a vision that we all have has to be a shared one. So in our political life, it isn't just so much about the leader being the paragon of all great things.
Like Rudd or Turnbull.
Exactly. Mm. They need to be surrounded by a really good team. And I think they also need to be surrounded by other leaders inside and outside politics that are prepared to, you know, pitch in with this vision. And also we need the community as well to come to the table. So this kind of idea of a white knight coming in, this great visionary leader to save us all from saving Australian democracy, is a problematic one because nobody, not even the most talented politician, can live up to that. I'm much more about what can we do with structural change and what can we do with really good working teams that have a real good mixture of, I suppose, skills and how can they deliver the vision? Mm. So I think this emphasis on leadership as of this kind of gifted individual has a lot of problems.
They've all got feet of clay anyway, haven't they?
Exactly. Well, there's only so much that an individual can do if the people around them. You can't be a leader if no one wants to follow you.
Yeah.
So you really do need a great team, and you need a team and you need a good backup team, and you need a whole lot of people dotted around society, in government, in business, in civil society to help you.
We'll see what we get. Are you looking forward to talking to people after the election to see what they want to say then?
I mean, election night's a really I've never ever got an election wrong. The kind of work I do, I can't really ever dictate the swing. So I'm often like pretty certain who's going to win, but I can't really say. It's like I know the ending of the book. I just don't know what the what all the characters are going to do going along. But it's always a bit nerve wracking because I'm like, oh, but you know, what's actually going to happen? I think there's always what's fascinating to me is how people read the result. So that is, and they often read the result not based on the evidence, but based on what they want to see. So if we see a real swing towards the Labor Party and a swing away from the Conservatives, some people in the Conservative parties will say, well, it's because we didn't take things like climate change seriously. And other people will say, no, we've got to swing more to the right. You know, we've got to be more. And so it is fascinating how people read research and read the data based on their own worldview.
We're back in the bubble again, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely back in the bubble.
Rebecca Huntley, the quarterly essay is Australia Fair with my guest, Dr. Rebecca Huntley. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.